Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
sifter.com.au.
I believe that I was put on this earth to make smiles happen, really. And so the most inspiring thing to me is when I go to an event and I see people having a great time, making memories, sitting down with each other, having fun. And if I've had something to do with that, it's incredibly fulfilling to me. It's really fun to see. And we you know, with Lord Connor, for example, we have had a tremendous following of families that come together to play. And that just, I mean, I get goosebumps right now just thinking about it, because it's such a wonderful thing to be a part of, to see like there's moms and dads and kids and they're getting together to play Lord Connor. And I just think, wow, what a wonderful thing I get to be a part of and get to create.
Hello, this is Lightmap from Sifter, our games interview show. I'm Gianni. Today, we're diving into the design of the trading card game Disney Lorcana with Ryan Miller, one of the co-designers from Ravensburger. Before we jump into that, let's find out what's been making the news on Walkthrough, Sifter's news podcast. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 8th of September.
Concord is cactus as Sony pulls the game from sales and issues refunds.
Acer gets into the handheld game market with the worst named console in history.
Randy Pitchford says, hey, cut us some slack. Even the Beatles had the occasional miss. Who famously didn't?
And the Minecraft movie trailer is out. Expect primary school kids to go bananas.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
Articles to read, podcasts to listen to, and videos to watch on sifter.com.au.
I'm going to start with a confession here. I know Aladdin off by heart, word for word, every lyric, every line of dialogue. To say that I watched it a few times would probably be underselling it. It's pretty true for a lot of the Disney films. They hold a pretty special place in my heart. And, you know, I've really recently had a chance to dig into the trading card game Disney Lorcana, which pulls from the Disney world and offers a game where options are pretty much limitless. And so, Ryan, I'm curious, you've got this game here, you've got a long history of designing card games and working in the game space, but Lightmap is a game design show where we like to dig into how people who make games got to where they are. Can you take us back to the beginning?
Oh.
What was the start of your game design journey?
Hello, so happy to be here. Thanks for having me on. Well, it actually started when I was like 11 years old. A friend of mine at school told me about Dungeons & Dragons. He was telling me, you know, he didn't tell me the rules. He just said, oh, it's a game where you get to play as knights and wizards and you go in dungeons and find treasure and you fight dragons. And I'm sure with every sentence, my eyes are just going, boop, 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 boop. Now, at that time, I didn't have access to the books. I couldn't get to the books. I was, you know, I couldn't afford them. I was like 11-year-old, like, you know, a limited liquid funds at the time. And so I started making up my own games and started really wrestling with questions about how to make these experiences, like, you know, if someone swings a sword, how do you know you hit? Now, at this time, I didn't even know that that game used dice. Had no idea. But I started working, you know, with that and really started to find that not only did I really enjoy it, I loved the challenge of it, but also kind of had a knack for it. I had, you know, I had something going on. Now, I'd say the other thing that started me on this journey was actually earlier than that. As I grew up in Southern California, about 2-hour drive north of Disneyland, and when I was a little boy, my grandmother would take me to Disneyland. And one of the things, even at that young age, I didn't know the word immersion. I couldn't have said that at that age, but I could feel it when I walked into that space. When you walk into Disneyland, you are transported to a whole different world. You know, you walk through, there's that brick archway, and you walk into Main Street USA, and then you take that left into Adventureland, or a further left into Frontierland. Just, you're just transported, right? And that was always so fascinating to me and so fun. And then later on, of course, when I got into tabletop gaming, I had a similar feel of like being transported. And I always loved that aspect of games, having me make decisions as if I was a submarine captain or a pirate ship captain or some other type of captain, lots of captains. and then, you know, fast forward a few years, I decide I was actually looking into a career in law enforcement. But I was in the U.S. Army for a few years, and after I got out of the Army, I decided, okay, I'm going to move to Seattle and try to get a job. That way, when I'm older and maybe I'm retired, I won't wonder. I won't be like, what if I had done it? What if I'd given it a real try? So I moved to Seattle. I got like the first job I got at Wizards of the Coast was actually working at their, they used to have this really beautiful tournament center near the University of Washington. And my first job was a magic judge. They're working at nights, 5 nights a week, judging magic tournaments. But kind of from there, I just would talk to anyone I could about game design and gamers and the whole thing, and really worked my way up through. I ended up working in retail during the summer of Pokemon back in '99, and then went up to corporate as a brand manager, and then eventually started a company with some friends of mine to do my first trading card game, which was co-designed between myself and Luke Peter Schmidt. It was the Warhammer 40K CCG that came out in 2000, or 2001 rather. And so it was really, you know, and then it was just years of that kind of work. And then finally, about 3 years later, I finally got the job I came to Seattle to get, which was working as a game designer at Wizards of the Coast. So it took me about 7 years after I moved to Seattle to get that. But all along the way, just learning so much. And then, of course, you know, Wizards is just a great place. I learned so much about game design. It was a unique environment. And then went freelance. In about 2014, I left Wizards to do freelance. I really wanted to make lots of different games, and started working with lots of different publishers, and I've been very fortunate to put out more games than, you know, I probably should have. and really had a great time with that. And then it was actually working on a freelance role for Ravensburger that I found out about this project. So I had been doing a game. I'd actually been working with Steve Warner, who's my co-designer on Lorcana. He was my game design manager when I was working with freelance. He was working inside Ravensburger. He was managing, and I was doing a board game based off of The Princess Bride, which is an 80s movie that classic. I don't know how,
yeah,
you know,
my era.
It's a great film. Yeah. I don't assume that like people outside America know it is. It's absolutely one of my favorite movies, and I pitched a design for it, and they picked it up, and so we were working together on that. And then as we were wrapping up a product, kind of design on that project, he tells me about this project. At that time, it was called Project Famous, because we hadn't come up with a name yet. When he told me about it, I have to admit, at first, I was kind of skeptical, because trading card games are really tough to make. They're more complicated on just about every level than a board game is. And board games are already a complicated product, right? It's not like I'm trying to say those are simple, because they are not. But when you add on the extra complexities from a product and design standpoint for a trading card game, it just really, you know, and so when a company, you know, wants to get into trading card games, it can be very challenging, right? And it is very challenging. But that, you know, so I was a little skeptical, and that was until I got a copy, my first copy of Princess Bride, and I saw how beautiful that game was. I mean, it was, the attention to detail was so high that it was very clear that this was made with a lot of love. Now, I know it was designed with a lot of love, because I love that movie. And, you know, it's been my favorite movie ever since it came out. One of my favorite movies since it came out. So, but to see how much love went into just the production and the art and everything else, and then I started looking into Villainous, which of course has been out for a while and has, you know, really done a great job, again, with that attention to detail, and just a beautiful game, a lot of fun gameplay. And I realized that, you know, they already have this kind of relationship with Disney fans and with Disney that's fairly unique. And I thought, wow, I went from being skeptical to feeling like Ravensburger might be the only company that could really do this right.
Well, it's interesting. Look, just hearing you talk about that, it's really clear that sort of game design has captured your imagination. You've got a history of doing this over many different ways. And I'm just wondering, you know, with this particular game, how can you take your imagination and sort of apply that to a new type of trading card game? Because it builds on the history of all the different games in the past. I guess people have played Pokemon, they might have played Yu-Gi-Oh, they might have played Magic back in the day, and they often maybe have never played anything at all because they might just be a Disney fan. And I'm just curious about your design intentions around making this game and where you kind of situated in the history of all the card games that have been in the past.
Yeah, so we, you know, the first step, I think, for a lot of game design is like, who is this for? That's the first step for, you know, depending on what you're trying to do, you know, who is this game for? And we really had to think about who we wanted to make this for. And we came up with two big groups. One group, of course, is trading card gamers, of which I count myself, you know, a part of that group. And the other is Disney fans, which I also count myself a part of that group. But we wanted a game where trading card gamers could find that really cool strategy and lots of skill testing moments and things like that. But that was still welcoming for Disney fans who have maybe never played, as you mentioned, you know, maybe have never played a card game like this before. And I think that trading card game design actually does this fairly well because the design itself, like the actual, you know, rules of the game, can be fairly welcoming. I was thinking of like the structure of a house, right? Like that's the game design itself. And it's got to be kind of solid, but it's got to have the stuff you need in it, right? It's got to have the kitchen and the bathrooms and the bedrooms and things like that. But the fun and the theme are really what the cards do, right? That's the job of the cards. And so we can make a welcoming design that is relatively easy for folks to pick up that have never played a game like this before, but that still allows that through card design and you know, that allows for that strategy, right? The strategy for a veteran trading card gamer will really be about like deck building and how they play their cards. But even in the basic design, there's some skill testing moments. I think the most obvious one is which card to put down as a resource, right? I think that's a very skill testing moment, not a new mechanic by any stretch of the imagination, but I think we did add a kind of nice twist to it because we have like not all cards can be used that way. And so that adds a lot of really interesting design and development. But anyway, going back to that, so we you know, figured out who we wanted to make this game for. And we kind of thought about, you know, you kind of have to put their hat on your head and think about it through their lens. Like, what would a player like this want? And really the Disney fan, you know, we felt like they just want to like put their favorite characters together and have them out on the table. And like anything that got in the way of that was kind of, you know, not something we wanted to do, right? It was, you know, we wanted to kind of move around that. So we really started with, you know, we at the beginning, we were never interested in making like an innovative design. I think the term innovation can be dangerous sometimes because really we weren't about innovating. We were about elevating the theme itself. We wanted the game design to get out of the way so that people could enjoy the themes and the characters, right? And that was most important to us. And so to that end, we put together a bunch of games. We started in November of 2021. Oh, my. Time in this era is so strange. Anyway, we started and we just started designing all these different card games and all these different ideas. And usually it followed this kind of trail of getting very excited. I know as a game designer, you've probably done this too, like, you know, getting very excited, very excited, very excited. And then you play it. And then something cracks the egg and you're like, no. And then you just kind of like, oh, that's not going to work. And you kind of put it to the wayside and you start over again. We probably did that about a dozen times before we got to a place that we really liked. Cause a lot of times we would say, okay, this is either getting in the way. Like we had a, early on, we had kind of an engine builder idea, like you would kind of put your cards out in a row, and then every turn you would resolve your row and then add to your row. And it was just getting in the way. It's like, I just want my fun characters out, right? It was just too much of like attention grabbing. Like, hey, everyone, look at this design. Look at it. And it's like, no, that's not why people are here. They're here for the characters and their stories, right? And so about 5 months in, we started to crystallize on the design that became Disney Ortana. And that's when, you know, we had been excited several times before this. So by this point, you're kind of jaded and you're kind of scared. You're waiting for like the shoe to drop. And the more we started playing it, the more we liked it. And we started kind of tweaking, you know, little aspects of it and playing again. And about 6 months after we started, we feel like we had pencils down on what we felt was a pretty fun design.
And I'm curious when you're now sort of going to be into your fifth sets, Shimmering Skies, just about to come out. Building on each of those individual sets that come out, if a player jumps in there, how do you sort of consider that from someone who's like, oh, I actually just like Wreck-It Ralph characters, so that's why I've got to go and buy this particular series. And then understanding that the game has kind of evolved if they're playing with a player who's playing with something from, the first chapter or something like that.
Yeah, it's a continual challenge with trading card game design. You have to remember that every set is someone's first set every time. And so you can never lose track of your new players. You must always remember them. Now, the nice thing is, every set we do is 200 plus cards, right? And what that means is that we have lots of slots for different types of cards for different players, right? And so when you're looking at designing a set for a trading card game, you have to look at it through the lens of different players and make sure you've got something there. So you look at it through the hardcore tournament player lens, you look at it from more of the casual or, fun lens, and you look at it from the new player lens as well. And so you've got to make sure that that you have something for everybody. And for newer players, you tend to want simpler cards at lower rarity. We had a phrase, and I don't know if it originated at Wizards, but we used it a lot at Wizards. We called it Azfan. And Azfan was like, as you fan a pack, what do you see? And we used a lot as like, okay, the Azfan of cost three or less is this, right? Like, or something like that. It was just a term of the shorthand to say, okay, we look at a set from the 10,000 foot level where we see every single card, but we also have to make sure we're looking at it as, what does this look like when you open a pack, right? Early on for us, a lot of that was making sure that you had those simpler cards at lower rarities, so that when a new player is fanning a pack, they're not overwhelmed with cards with lots of words on them and that sort of thing. Because that can, especially when you're first learning any game, those kinds of things can be fairly intimidating. So, and we also want to make sure our Azfan had high distribution of ink. So we want to make sure that, no matter what ink you're playing, you're always going to find a few cards in your pack. And then we also want to make sure that we had a lot of different franchises in the pack as well. So there's a lot of ways that you have to kind of look at it. We add, I spoke about those three types of players, but there's a fourth that we add, a lens that we look through, and that's the Disney fan themselves, to make sure that when they fan a pack, they get to see a nice mix of characters they know and love, but also occasionally we'll see those deeper cuts. And I think those are really important as well. And so it's just a really interesting way, and challenging way too, because we're doing a set every quarter. So this is a process that we're always working and iterating on, and always looking at the sets through these different lenses. But you really got to make sure when you're designing a game like this that you are not just designing for one player. You're designing for lots of different kinds of players and using your card set in a way that caters to those players at different levels.
What's the overall design intention behind Shimmering Skies? How are you changing the game for this particular set?
Well, I think our main thing was, so we're just getting off a narrative arc. So the first four sets were all about Ursula trying to basically take over the realm of Lorcana. She makes her own Illuminary, which you can kind of see in some of the art, especially for Illuminar's Quest. And so in set five, we wanted to kind of go back to the Illuminary, kind of go back to our basics, right? And we feel like we're going to get a lot more Disney fans coming in at this stage because we have a really cool thing going on at D23, which happens in a week and a half now. And we're hoping that a lot of Disney fans at D23 and then throughout the world will kind of see this and try to get into it. So what we wanted to do is kind of go back from a design standpoint and also from a theme standpoint. So what we don't want to do, and this is just about any set, is add too much complexity in every set or too much new mechanics or things like that. Because we feel that, again, since every set is someone's first set, if you're adding new mechanics every single set, those can have this kind of combinatorial effect that after a while, the game, even though you're just doing the stuff that has been already established, can feel pretty heavy to someone who's just coming in at this stage, right? So while we do, of course, have new mechanics in the set, on the cards, what we didn't do is like add a new card type like we did in set three with location cards and things like that. Those types of mechanical jumps have to be deployed cautiously because they all involve additional complexity.
Do you sort of see, you say you're releasing them every quarter, but do you see those sort of larger mechanical steps as something you do every year? Is that kind of about the sort of time frame you're thinking?
We do them as needed, but I think every year is approximately correct. Like, you know, we really, so when you're thinking about any game, but trading card games specifically, we have what we would call design space. And design space is, you know, I talked about the house and like the basic rules and that foundational stuff. That foundation creates an amount of design space, and design space is simply what cards can do. What can cards do in this world? And the more complication you have in your game, the bigger your design space, right? Because there's just more stuff that cards can do. Now, of course, the downside of more complication is there's potential barrier to entry to some folks because, you know, it might be too much for them or something like that. And so the goal, at least in my opinion, is maximum design space with minimal complicating effects, right? But what you want to make sure is that any complication you put in your game yields maximum ratio of design space, while also, I like to say, also paying for itself in fun, right? You can add a complicated rule to your game, but if that rule is fun as well, then people are more likely to go, well, it's a little complicated, but it's kind of fun. Like, you know, I'm building a farm, or I'm doing this, or I'm doing that, or, you know, like locations, I think, are a good example of this. They do add a decent amount of complication. They also, of course, add a lot more design space, both for location cards and for other cards to support them or call to them. But they're also kind of fun because, you know, you're moving your characters to them. So there's this like thematic, like, oh, you know, I've got Peter Pan at Pride Rock. That's just fun to say, right? And so they have this way of kind of paying their own rent, so to speak. And I think that's, when possible, that's very important for game design, is like, make sure your complication pays for itself as much as possible and provides as much design space as you can get out of it with minimal, you know, minimizing that ratio of complexity to design space.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I couldn't go without asking you this. You're at D23. Sure, Elsa and Anna and Aladdin are a big part of that, but there's also Star Wars, there's also Marvel. Is that something that Lorcana could potentially visit in future sets?
I like to call that a Bruno question, and I just don't talk about Bruno. You know, it's like, you know, I just don't talk about Bruno. We don't talk about Bruno.
What outside of the game you're making, what is the most inspiring thing for you when designing games?
I believe that I was put on this earth to make smiles happen, really. And so the most inspiring thing to me is when I go to an event and I see people having a great time, making memories, sitting down with each other, having fun. And if I've had something to do with that, it's incredibly fulfilling to me. It's really fun to see. And we you know, with Lorcana, for example, we have had a tremendous following of families that come together to play. And that just, I mean, I get goosebumps right now just thinking about it, because it's such a wonderful thing to be a part of, to see like these moms and dads and kids, and they're getting together to play Lorcana. And I just think, wow, what a wonderful thing I get to be a part of and get to create. I think that, you know, tabletop games are such a great way to make memories with friends and family and to relate with each other. And it's a great way to experience your relationships with other folks. And so to be a part of that is incredibly inspiring and fulfilling. And I'm always thinking about, how can I make my experiences better? How can I add more fun? I mean, it's just always on my mind because I owe it to them. I believe that I owe it to my players. They're the ones spending their time and money on what I do. And so I kind of owe them as much of, you know, the best experience I can give them based on the time and resources I have, of course. But I just love it. You know, that feeling you get when you have purchased a gift for somebody and you're excited for them to open it. Like, that's my job. Like, that's what I do. Like, I'm so excited for people to open this up and enjoy it and have fun with it. It's really just a wonderful business to be in. I'm just so proud of what our team has done to bring Lorcana to Australia and New Zealand. And, you know, it's that little 11-year-old kid who started, you know, trying to make his own D&D game, you know, to have worked on a game that is now in so many countries and you know, now in so many places. And it's just an honor to be a part of this.
I can hear the joy in your voice. It was such a genuine pleasure to talk to you, Ryan. Thank you so much for sharing.
You as well. Thank you so much.
The design behind Disney Lorcana. Shimmering Skies is out on August 9th /10th here in Australia in game stores. And then later this month, it'll be available all over the place. And you could find out more in the show notes. Head to sifter.com.au. We'll find links to everything we've talked about, including some of our looks at the previous series. So thank you so much, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for your time, Gianni. Had a blast. And I hope to come down and visit y'all at some point in the next year or so.
Hi, Chris Button here from Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Star Wars Outlaws gives you a unique look at a galaxy far, far away, with a focus on the scheming, unforgiving criminal underworld.
I thought
when playing originally, that Nyx would have been sort of like something I'd use occasionally, but it became pretty integral to the gameplay. You're kind of always like looking at the angles and seeing, well, okay, what can I do over here? How can I cause a distraction? Do I want to set an explosion off over there to draw attention over there? Or do I want to use that explosive barrel to blow up a few enemies? So, you know, there's a quite an interesting variety in the way that you can approach each particular, which I found really fun. When it breaks bad, you're just like, all right, here we go. It's a Star Wars time.
So does it deliver on its galactic size potential? Find out on Drop Rate, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
This has been Lightmap Sifter's interview podcast. Thanks to Ryan Miller, Disney Lorcana's brand manager and co-designer from Ravensburger. Sifter is produced by Carl Paletto, Fiona Bartholomaeus, Courtney Smith, Adam Christou, and Chris Button. Mitch Lowe is senior producer, and my name is Gianni Di Giovanni. I'm Sifter's executive producer. Thanks to Audio Technica Australia and Apple for their support of Sifter. And if you've subscribed to us on one of our platforms, have you thought about checking us out on the website, sifter.com.au? You can find videos, you can find reviews, stuff that doesn't appear anywhere else. Head to sifter.com.au for more information. Make sure you make that as part of your bookmarks. That's all the time we have for now. Catch you on the next episode of Lightmap, and until next time, have fun.